Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. President Trump made good on a campaign promise Tuesday to roll back Obama-era efforts to fight climate change, going after the clean power plan, stoking the coal industry. Along coastlines in this country and abroad, climate change is a very real, sometimes existential threat. Some communities are armoring up with walls and levees. Others are looking at retreat. This hour on Point, communities in managed retreat from climate change. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Will climate change send you moving away from the sea? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Later this hour, we'll take a broader look at the effects of President Trump's environmental actions earlier this week. But first, rising sea levels and managed retreat. Joining me now from Stanford, California's Miyuki Hino, PhD student at Stanford University studying the environment and resources. She's the lead author of a paper published Monday in the science journal Nature Climate Change titled Managed Retreat as a Response to Natural Hazard Risk. Nice sciencey sounding name. Miyuki Hino, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Tom. It's great to be here.
A lot of people thinking about climate change this week with a big change in American policy on that front. But all this didn't start this week, and it won't end next week. You're looking at managed retreat. How widely within the United States and globally do you think this is going to be something that communities have to consider?
Well, we really set out in our study to try to understand how managed retreat fits into a range of adaptation options that we have for the future as we're looking at sea levels rising, more communities facing more frequent flooding, risks from erosion and hurricanes. And we found that this is, in fact, already happening from all over the world. We have, you know, many communities in the U.S. that have responded in some way by moving out of the way of floods or hurricanes. And that's very similar to what we see in Europe, in South Asia, in East Asia, Australia, and even in Pacific Islands.
How does a community begin to think about this? Whether if rising sea levels and other factors lead a community to feel it's really in trouble, how does it begin to calculate whether the right response, because a lot is invested in homes and businesses and infrastructure, whether the right response is to stay and fight in effect or to go, Miyuki?
Well, there's no question that even considering managed retreat is really tough and really complex, and particularly so because there are such high intangible costs. But we do find that there are communities out there thinking that it is the best option for them. And in some cases, you know, some people might find that there are better job opportunities somewhere else, and their financial or their economic context might improve if they move. For other communities, a planned relocation effort is one way for them to stay close to their neighbors and to preserve the social networks that they have. And in other situations, by moving out of the way, communities are able to restore coastal ecosystems and beaches to their former state. So we see a lot of different reasons why different communities are pursuing managed retreat, but it's clear that it's never easy.
I mean, if things really get tough, how does this decision get made? Are we going to have teams that go around the United States and say, all right, town A or city A, you know, economically and otherwise, you're in a position to build more walls or whatever it might be against rising seas, but community C and D, you're not. How's that decision get made?
That's a really great question, and we find different settings everywhere we look. I think the best way to think about managed retreat decision-making is as a negotiation between different groups. And, you know, two of the key groups involved are, of course, the residents, the people on the ground that are confronting the risks. And often the other group is a government agency at some level that's going to make the move happen. And in some cases, the push to relocate is really from the government agency side, and it may not be the first option that the residents would like to pursue. We also see the exact opposite situation, where the residents are the ones pushing for relocation, and they may or may not be getting the support from a government agency to do so.
Is the U.S. Is the U.S. set up with government agencies who have this as their mission, their task to see who should stay and who should go as seas rise?
Well, we're still learning about how to do managed retreat. We're still learning about what it means to adapt to climate change and where we're going to pursue different options. So, you know, the U.S. does not have a really formalized system in place for making decisions about which communities are best suited to which adaptation options, but that's a challenge that we're all facing because we, you know, as society, we've never faced a situation like this before where we know that the future isn't going to look like the past, but we don't know exactly what to prepare for and how to prepare.
I mean, the last century, ocean seas rose something like 5 inches globally. This century, several feet of sea rise are projected, you know, more or less, depending on how we respond. And this week, the U.S. pulling back from a significant portion of its response. I saw one analysis here saying that there could be as many as 470 million people globally whose homes would be eventually submerged. That's a lot of people on the move. What's the range of community sizes that you looked at in your survey, Miyukihino? Are you just looking at little villages pulling back from the coast in Alaska? Or are you looking at significant communities?
Well, we see we do see small villages, whether that's in Alaska or in the Pacific Islands, where it's, you know, dozens, maybe 100 people that are trying to relocate or relocating. But we also see after, often in the wake of major disasters, we see hundreds of thousands of people moving at once. For instance, after Typhoon Haiyan in the Philippines, the government decided that within a certain distance of the coast, it would be better not to rebuild. And an estimated million people were going to have to move as a result of that. As you said, there will be people moving in a changing climate. I think the question is how that move happens. And managed retreat is one way of trying to coordinate and plan that move strategically so that we can best meet our collective goals while doing so.
You've looked at some of this in the United States. Where? What's happened?
So the most common way that we do managed retreat in the United States is after a big hurricane or a flood takes place, the Federal Emergency Management Agency will come in and offer certain houses buyouts. And what that means is they will offer the homeowner some amount of money. And if the homeowner accepts, the government will buy your house, take down the property, and just restore it to open space. And FEMA tends to target houses that are likely to be damaged again in future disasters. And they do that because it will save taxpayers money in the long term if we don't have to worry about disaster relief and recovery for that property.
So
that's about, we think that about 100,000 people have been bought out through this process since the early 1980s. And that's one of the big tools that the U.S. has at its disposal to do managed retreat in the future.
I mean, how does that stack up against kind of government-subsidized hunkering down in place? We've got a lot of insurance out there that also covers people along the coasts. I mean, the American policy so far seems more oriented toward hunkering in place rather than moving, does it not?
Well, as I said earlier, if you think about managed retreat as a negotiation between different groups, then the negotiation is going to work out best when everyone's incentives are aligned. And for a variety of reasons, the people in these coastal or flood-prone areas, the local governments and the federal government may not have their incentives aligned in the same way. And that's a huge challenge for managed retreat. It might encourage local governments and people in those places to develop and reside in really hazard-prone areas. But ultimately, it might be the federal government that's responsible for footing the bill when the disaster comes through. So in the future, aligning those incentives is going to be really important to making this happen more smoothly.
We seem really conflicted on this. A lot of, pricey coastal real estate. And at the same time, here comes the future. Dean in Hyde Park, Massachusetts. Dean, thanks for calling. You're on there with Miyuki Hino in Stanford, California. Hi, Dean.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I wanted to see if we could go a little bit deeper, and I know it's early on in mm-hmm. your show,
mm-hmm.
But the chasm that currently exists between any conversation about managed retreat and what I see in certain coastal communities in the United States and abroad. I was just in Puerto Rico last weekend, and you have hotels that are, high-rise hotels within less than 50 feet of the tide line. You see this in southern Florida.
Sure.
My son went to college in Miami, and, the amount of high-rise luxury hotel and apartment buildings that are built right on these barrier islands, this sort of short-term profit is if climate change and sea level rise didn't exist. I'm not saying that we shouldn't have a conversation about managed retreat because it's a stupid idea and no one's paying attention. That's not my point. My question is, what will it take to tip the balance? Is it going to be some kind of massive natural disaster? What's it going to get the real estate community, the local government? Right now, it really does seem to be the opposite of it.
Dean, you're breaking up, but I think we've got it. Super mansions going up right on the coast, barely above the sea level. What's your observation, Miyuki? What is it that gets people thinking another way, maybe not sinking a foundation here, but pulling up stakes and moving inland?
Well, there are a lot of different reasons why someone might come to the idea that the settings are right for them to move instead for them to anchor down in place. Real estate markets are one key signal for that. As soon as property values start going down, you might see people moving. But certainly, managed retreat is not a tool that we currently have in our adaptation toolkit. So to the extent that we can change the development incentives and policies so that we can really consider it in the places where it makes sense, the better off we'll be in the future.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about climate change, sea level rise, and a new focus on managed retreat. From American and global coasts, coastal communities, who may go where and how and when. Miyuki Hino is with us from Stanford, lead author of a paper published this week in Nature Climate Change, headline, Managed Retreat as a Response to the Natural Hazard Risk. It's out there. You can join us this hour. Do you live in one of these areas? Do you wonder if this may be you or your kids who one day have to go? Is your community in stand and fight mode? Walls, levees, barriers? Could you imagine your community in a managed retreat from climate-driven sea rise? Miyuki, please stand by there in California. I want to go to Alaska for a minute, if I may. Anchorage, Alaska, and Robin Bronin, senior research scientist at the Institute of Arctic Biology at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks. She studies rising sea levels, disappearing ice, melting permafrost, how all that affects communities. Robin Bronin, thanks very much for being with us from Anchorage.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for the opportunity.
Is Alaska tasting this future already?
Yes, we've been actually facing it for the last couple of decades.
And are you engaged in managed retreat? Are you helping or watching communities actually leave the coastline?
Yes, so in 2009, the federal government did a report on Alaska Native villages that were imminently threatened by flooding and erosion. And at that time, they found that 12 communities in Alaska were making the decision to relocate as their best long-term adaptation strategy.
What have you learned from Alaskan communities who have decided it's necessary to do this, that we might have in mind in the lower 48, Robin?
So what I've learned in the past decade of following the relocation issues in Alaska, which gets to your previous questions, is the challenge in the United States and really all over the world is we do not have what I call a governance framework to address the need to relocate populations prior to an extreme weather event happening. So the way that most of the managed retreats happen and what is made possible based on the laws of the United States that mandate FEMA to assist communities is that most of the relief that happens after an extreme weather event. That's when the financing becomes available. And to facilitate a relocation or managed retreat when there is not an extreme weather event, when it is, for instance, erosion causing land to permanently disappear, we have no institutional mechanism to make that possible.
Robin, what's the largest community you've seen relocated in Alaska? You know, you've got a relatively sparse population there compared to the lower 48.
So the largest community, no community has yet relocated. That's really important to know because of this lack of a governance framework.
Okay.
And the largest community that is seeking to relocate is a population of about 1,000 people.
And what are they up against? What's happening to the structure of their community?
Well, because of decreased Arctic sea ice, we have had record low extents of Arctic sea ice. And Arctic sea ice used to be a natural barrier along the coastlines of Alaska. And without that barrier, when storms come in that are as strong as hurricanes, that barrier isn't there, and it's causing accelerated rates of erosion because the land is also the permafrost, which is permanently frozen ground in the northwest part of Alaska, is melting. So the erosion is accelerating and damaging and destroying the infrastructure and dwellings in these communities.
Robin Bronin, please stand by in Anchorage, Alaska. Miyuki Hino in Stanford, California. Ben Strauss joins us right now via Skype from Princeton, New Jersey. Ecologist, evolutionary biologist. He's VP for Sea Level and Climate Impacts at Climate Central. Ben Strauss, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Tom. Thanks so much for having me on.
Miyuki Hino and her colleagues have been looking at this all over the world and around the U.S. Robin's right in the thick of it there in Alaska, where it's kind of a canary in the coal mine, early effects there. How much of the United States, you know, mainland, lower 48 coast, may be impacted in such a way that it will end up considering managed retreat from the coast, Ben?
Eventually, pretty much all of it. We've really changed from a world in which sea level was stable to one in which it's going to be rising for hundreds of years. And we're at the beginning of that time. Eventually, almost every place is going to be affected, but the first places are going to be South Florida and Louisiana, I would say, and some spots around the Chesapeake Bay.
And what kind of populations are we talking about, and what kind of timetable?
So South Florida has the biggest population, and depending on how much more carbon we put in the atmosphere and how lucky we are, really, how sensitive the climate and sea level turns out to be to that carbon, South Florida may lose its kind of viability as a place to live later in this century. And it will be impossible to defend there, really, in the long run, because the bedrock is like Swiss cheese. It's full of holes. So you can't really build a levee to keep the sea out.
I don't know how much you can bring down to particular policies, but we've had a big turn in American policy on energy and climate change this week. Do you see that as changing the trajectory of what's happening with sea rise and what the futures may be for American coastal communities, Ben?
It very well could. The United States today is the world's second largest emitter. Fortunately, we don't control, you know, all fossil fuel emissions in the world, all greenhouse gas emissions. But if we undermine the international will, the international momentum, we have, then that would be a large blow that would reduce our chances of really holding back this problem. We have the chance to be a leader in accelerating, you know, a new global energy economy and clean energy. And without our leadership, I think that's going to develop a lot more slowly. Just to give a sense of the stakes here, I'd say that the mainstream scientific feeling has been that we might see 2 or 3 feet of sea level rise by the end of the century on average globally. And that is already going to be pretty tough to swallow for South Florida, but will be manageable in most places. But now we see a much higher end extreme sea level scenario that's possible. A new NOAA technical report was released this January, suggesting that we could see 10 feet or more this century around U.S. shores. And we double the chances of that happening by staying on a dirty energy path. And that's just what this administration has pointed us on.
Ben, stand by. I want to get our listeners in here. Clinton, Illinois. Anne is calling. Hi, Anne. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Really just three words. New York City, home of our current president. That's a different type of community than some of the small Alaskan villages. And yep. Just wondered what kind of comments.
New York City. Okay, there's a city that's right on the water. Miyukihino, did your research look at communities of that scale and think about what it would take? I know you've looked at some smaller ones. Do the lessons you see in smaller cities apply to big ones? Or is there so much investment there that there'll be an endless appetite to invest in protection, in resilience is the word we've heard a lot about?
Well, managed retreat is not going to be the answer for everyone. But even in New York, after Hurricane Sandy, there were certain communities on Staten Island that really pushed for the federal government to support them with buyouts. And one in particular, Oakwood Beach on Staten Island, over half of the neighborhood there agreed to be bought out and for that land to be restored to open space. And I think this idea of combining all of the different options that we have available to us, whether that's building levees in certain locations, retreating in other locations, and reinforcing infrastructure in others, that's the type of mindset that we should be using to adapt to climate change in the future. And it's going to be a different mix in different places, but having all of those options on the table is really important.
Robin Bronin in Anchorage, Alaska, do you see the lessons Alaska's learned so far scaling up for quite large communities, or that just doesn't work that way?
No, absolutely. And I'm originally from New York and was there when Hurricane Sandy happened. So I've been following New York City's decisions in regard to how they are going to protect themselves from sea level rise. And it's a really difficult question to answer because, as you know, Manhattan is an island. And so how high do you build those seawalls to deal with the fact that we are warming our climate at an unprecedented place? And if we can't build those seawalls high enough, then for certain, for instance, Lower Manhattan is going underwater. And so from the perspective of doing the work that I've done in Alaska, it is urgent that we figure out a governance framework so that people aren't in crisis and that we can actually have a managed retreat before there's another hurricane that comes and displaces millions of people.
Janine in Mandeville, Louisiana. Thank you for calling, Janine. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm a citizen that lives on the coast on the north shore of Lake Pontchartrain, and I'm taking part in a series of public hearings in Louisiana right now,
okay,
which are dedicated to giving us a comprehensive master plan for a sustainable coast. I'm not an expert, but your experts have correctly said that Louisiana is going to be one of the places that's the most severely affected by sea level rise.
And we saw what happened after Katrina with New Orleans and the coastline there. Are people in your neck of the woods talking about hunkering down, putting up higher walls, or potentially moving, Janine?
Both. And that's what this series of meetings is about.
Mm-hmm.
When you experience many, what they call severe repetitive losses from flooding, then there's just no way that you can continue that. And I think that we really need to have a comprehensive program that gives many options for what the people can do here. We have seen some communities far south on the coast already have to relocate. They're just not viable anymore. And we had a peculiar problem here, which was the BP oil spill several years ago.
Sure.
it accelerated our erosion losses tremendously.
And some have had to go. Janine, I appreciate your call from the front line there in Louisiana. Miyuki, you've looked a bit at Louisiana and what's gone on there.
Yes, so there's a community on Ile de Jean Charles in southern Louisiana that recently was awarded federal money to relocate, and that process is underway now. I think in some ways it is a great model for how we might be able to keep communities intact and also get a lot more local support and local buy-in and local control over relocation outcomes. At the same time, this is going to be happening in more places, whether that's in Alaska, Louisiana, South Florida in the future. And we certainly don't have a systematic way of allocating money to different adaptation options in different places.
Herb in Palm Beach, Florida, on the coast. Herb, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Well, I'm curious, what is a formula that results in the drastic change in the conclusions mentioned earlier about erosion?
You mean erosion or the number of feet of sea level rise? Which do you mean, Herb?
No, the claim is that change in energy practices will reduce the amount of erosion.
I think the claim is that the change in energy practice that I heard from Ben Strauss is may lead to much higher sea level rise than had been anticipated. Am I getting you?
And what is the because he mentioned a specific rate.
Yeah. They were thinking 2 to 3 feet, and now NOAA, the National Oceanic and Aeronautic Administration, saying maybe 10 plus. Let's pick it up. Ben Strauss, what kind of formula? What do you throw at a problem like that globally to come up with such a dramatic shift in potential projection?
Yeah, it is a dramatic shift. And the reason for that possibility of the larger scenario is Antarctica. Until recently, most scientific projections of sea level rise predicted that there would be almost no contribution from Antarctica this century. But new research that came out a year ago pointed to a very strong possibility that the West Antarctic ice sheet could destabilize this century. And that's something that we really want to minimize the chances of happening. Miyuki, that makes the difference.
Yeah. Miyuki, how does this work? We had the show in Florida, in Tampa, just a couple weeks ago. And, you know, in that area, there's all kinds of houses, but including some mega mansions, a lot of them right on the water. And people there were saying, well, you know, at some point, the quite wealthy people on the coast, who, of course, that's valuable property, who have a pretty big megaphone if they choose to pick it up, may feel like they have an interest in some kind of change on policy here. I mean, what tends to get communities to move on this, Miyuki? Is it when the rich guy's mansion is in trouble, or it's when 1,000 people are in trouble, or what?
Well, we're right at the start of seeing these dramatic changes in sea level and the impacts that they might have. You do have a case in Miami Beach in Florida where the frequency of flooding has gotten so high that they've mobilized, I think, about $400 million to install pumps, to raise roads, to do everything that they need to do infrastructure-wise to keep their community resilient and safe. That's one way of going about it. I think there are other policies in place. There's insurance and how we price risk for people that are living in these really hazardous locations that can also change the calculus for individual homeowners in those places. But, you know, we're still new to this and we're still learning what the causes are, what the levers we have to make those changes are. And it's certainly, there's plenty more research to be done.
Ben, is there anybody sitting in Washington with a map of the United States that shows here's the coast now, here's where it will be, and here's where we need to plan for moves?
I'm afraid maybe not anymore. There had been a lot of progress in that direction, but not so much anymore. I think that is very important, though, to realize that sea level is rising everywhere, and not every community has the same amount of resources, and this will be a huge equity issue. So Miami Beach is spending $500 million that they've taxed themselves to fix it. Atlantic City, same size, barrier island, same kind of threat, is just falling apart.
This On Point podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 200 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 500 companies and hundreds of thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/OP.
Hi, it's Tom. Thanks for listening to this On Point podcast. I want you to take a moment to think about the people you care about. Have they ever listened to a podcast? All this month, we're asking our listeners to tell a friend about a podcast they love. This one? Another one? Do it in real life or on social media, and if they don't know how to download them, give them a quick lesson. You'll be opening up a new world for them. Tell us what you're recommending with the hashtag TryPod. That's hashtag TryPod, and thanks. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about climate change, sea level rise, and a new focus on managed retreat from American and global coasts, coastal communities, who may go where and how and when. Miyuki Hino has got a lot of people talking. She's done a big study of managed retreat, examples of it around the world. She's with us from Stanford this hour. Robin Bronin's looking at this in Alaska, where this is a clear and present and imminent and right now question, has been for some time. She joins us from the University of Alaska in Fairbanks is her home base there. Ben Strauss is with us from Climate Central, joins us today via Skype from Princeton, New Jersey. You can join us as well. Could you imagine your community in a managed retreat from climate-driven sea rise? Are you thinking more about it this week as the U.S. backs away from measures to fight climate change? And how do you picture our coasts, coastal communities, cities, 50 or 100 years from now, floating like Venice or walled like Holland, in a bowl like New Orleans? Gone? Ethan in Saco, Maine. Ethan, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I agree with a lot of what you guys are saying. I just would like to say, whoa, back up the truck a second, and ask, where is there any real data on how much the sea levels are rising now? Well, my father lives on the coast, like 50 feet from the coast in Maine, and I haven't seen a lot of, I mean, there's always some erosion going on.
Sure.
But I haven't seen a lot of sea level rise there at all. However, I do know the Alaska thing is real.
Yep.
My mother lives in Florida. She said that the seawater is getting into the springs down there.
The freshwater is getting into the
springs, which is an issue. But where is there any data about the actual increases that are happening now? I know a lot of you guys, you're talking about projections and stuff, but what's going on now?
Ben, talk about what's gone on already, what's going on right now, and how that might relate to what's to come. But, you know, Ethan walks out on the beach at his father's place in Maine and doesn't really see it.
Yeah, so we, in fact, are measuring sea level rise that's happening right now. NOAA has an extensive network of tide gauges that have been taking data, some for more than 100 years, that show a very clear rise in sea level all around the United States. Different parts are rising at different rates. We also, since the early 90s, have evidence from satellites covering the whole global surface of the ocean that sea level is rising and has been accelerating recently.
So if Ethan doesn't feel like he sees it, what does that mean?
Well, you know, the tide comes up and down every day.
Yeah, we heard.
It's hard to see it. Sometimes at a specific location, but along the coast of Maine, actually, sea level is rising around 2 millimeters a year. So 2 centimeters, an inch every decade, and that's going to be hard to see. It's not rising as fast as some other places.
And if it goes to a 2 or 3 foot rise in this century, or the 10 foot plus sort of nightmare scenario,
What's the curve on that look like? Does it creep up for some years and then get dramatically higher? Or is it a steady gain in sea level? What's the projection look like, the sort of arc of the graph?
It's definitely an acceleration, a mild acceleration for the next few decades. In the really extreme sea level scenario, there would be a sharp acceleration in the second half of the century when Antarctic decay really kicks in.
Let's go to Tom in Baltimore. Tom, thank you for calling. You're on the air. Hello, Tom. Are you there, my friend?
Besides residential relocation, many infrastructures, such as municipal sewage plants and old hazardous waste landfills, are built right on the water. And when the sea level rises and it gets into those areas, they'll have to be moved at great expense. Also, things like hazardous waste landfills, you can't really move them. But as the sea level rises, it's going to intrude into that stuff, leach that material out, and get it into the water. What people are going to do about that?
Yeah, let us look at it. Miyuki, did you look at that? I mean, it's not just sort of loading the trunk of the car and everybody driving off. There's a lot that sits there. How does infrastructure figure in when managed retreat comes to look like the best option, Miyuki?
Well, you're absolutely right. We do have power plants, landfills, wastewater treatment plants of all kinds along the coast. In fact, we do see public agencies taking measures on their own land to relocate those things. For instance, there have been lighthouses, which obviously are very exposed to sea level rise, that have been moved, whether that's a couple hundred yards or something like that, inland. There will be costs that public agencies have to bear to figure out what to do about those power plants, those landfills, and so forth. But I think the added complexity of residential relocation, people moving, makes it a really different type of challenge than the challenge of finding new places and finding the money to move infrastructure.
There's a lot to deal with, even if you're leaving Ben, yeah?
Yeah, Tom, if I may, I'd like to point out a resource that could be useful for the caller and listeners. It's called riskfinder.org, and you can look up how much stuff is under different sea level rise increments all over the United States. So, for example, in New Jersey, there are more than 1,000 EPA-certified hazardous waste sites less than 5 feet above the high tide line, and 2,000 within 10 feet. So the caller is absolutely right. We have a tremendous amount of stuff that we don't want to get wet in the lowest elevations.
Get one more call here. Nancy in Jonesboro, Maine. Nancy, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. I'm an organic farmer right on the Atlantic Ocean, only a few hundred yards from Route 1, and I can tell you that this is U.S. Route 1, that it occasionally floods here in town. But, you know, one solution that I would propose is that we have no more personality politics, all this, you know, attacking one another, that all this new activism that has arisen, that we demand our elected officials face up that we must stop burning fossil fuels, and new activists, please run for office. And we have to stop clear-cutting our forests. We have to grow our own food. I mean, we are in for chaos. I'm a long-time observer. The ocean is creeping up into my apple trees. This is happening. There's empirical evidence out there for anybody who wants to see it.
Nancy, you could say the new activism is going the other way. I mean, Donald Trump was newly elected, and by people who got active to do that. And this week...
I'm in Maine, and we have all kinds of progressives and radicals and so on getting really, really angry. This is all over the country. I don't know if you've heard of the new Indivisible movement. Just look up the word Indivisible, and you'll find there are like 10,000 groups of progressives and new activists all over the country.
We've got people pulling in different directions. Yeah, we hear it. I hear it loud and clear, and we know it. It is fascinating how people pull in different directions, even in the face of a moment like this. This is pretty darn interesting. Miyuki Hino at Stanford, I'm really glad you did this research, sort of laying out the grid of ways to respond to this challenge, how communities have done it so far, how they might most effectively contemplate this in the future. Miyuki, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks. It's been great to be here.
Robin Bronin in Anchorage, Alaska, based in Alaska at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Robin, thank you for giving us a little bit of the Alaska experience. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And Ben Strauss, a ecologist, evolutionary biologist at Climate Central, with us today from Princeton, New Jersey. Thank you for being here, Ben.
My pleasure.
In a moment, we'll take a closer look at the executive order President Trump signed Tuesday and the impact of the White House shift in environmental policy. This is On Point. On Tuesday, President Trump fulfilled a campaign promise to undo environmental regulations put in place by his predecessor that were designed to tackle the roots of climate change. The president says deregulation is necessary in order to revitalize the nation's energy industry. It's a big move at a key moment. We want to look at just how big. Here was President Trump at the EPA outlining plans to get rid of regulations he says restrict American energy and hurt jobs.
We're going to have safety, we're going to have clean water, we're going to have clean air, but so many are unnecessary and so many are job-killing. We're getting rid of the bad ones.
President Trump on Tuesday this week. We want to look at the implications of the shift, some might say the U-turn, that the U.S. is taking right now. Joining me from Berkeley, California is Daniel Kamen, professor of energy at the University of California, co-director of the Berkeley's Institute of the Environment. Daniel Kamen, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
When historians look back on climate and energy use and how humans have responded to the challenge that we're seeing now, what do you think they're going to make of this week and American government policy?
Well, I fear they're going to highlight the degree to which we've learned so much over the last couple decades. And the U.S. and China, as partners, had turned the corner on understanding the extreme benefits of jobs, of economic growth, of the transition. And they will see this as a significant bump in the road unless we find ways to undo what so far has been looking like a very ugly set of ill-informed decisions, I fear.
The U.S., we're reading on front pages today, the U.S. kind of giving up leadership in terms of tackling climate change, giving it up to China. Do you buy that? Is it possible or is it a fact that China is taking over as the big nation? And I must say, they too have a lot of pollution there, but as the big nation who's most focused on changing this, tackling this?
Well, that's the irony. Certainly 5 years ago, no one was seeing the U.S. and China as the two big leaders. In fact, the U.S. and China are about 40% of global energy use, about 40% of greenhouse gas pollution, and both were seen as trying to transition, but not fully engaged. But over the last few years, under President Obama, a really exceptional series of events happened. The U.S. and China came together at a global changing summit in 2014, and at the climate conferences, both in Paris and then the most recent one in Marrakesh, the proposals by the U.S. and Chinese were not just good words. They were really significant. As an example, China, in the last few months, coinciding with Mr. Trump's victory, announced they were going to triple down, if you will, on green energy and invest $360 billion to very clearly cement a leadership position, which they relayed to me directly as a void they see Mr. Trump creating. So I think China is absolutely stepping forward. But you're right, China has lots of environmental problems of their own. There are significant air quality problems that get lots of press. But this is really a push to not only address those domestic problems, but to really be the global supplier of clean tech, of clean energy technologies worldwide, both air and water. And that's why it's so sad and ironic to see the U.S. stepping away from a point when we were really poised to take advantage of all this research we've been doing over the last decades.
Dean, your line has deteriorated on us a little bit. Let me play some tape of the little bit of the evolution of Donald Trump on this front and bring it right up to date as well. We'll see if we can redial you in the meantime and get a clearer line there. Let's go back to December of 2016. Then President-elect Trump telling Fox News anchor Chris Wallace that he had not decided, if climate change was really occurring.
Where are you on the environment?
I'm still open-minded. Nobody really knows. I'm somebody that gets it. And nobody really knows. It's not something that's so hard and fast. I do know this. Other countries are eating our lunch.
Nobody really knows, said President-elect Trump. Of course, that's not what scientists overwhelmingly say. And here's another bit from that Fox News interview with Chris Wallace about the Paris Climate Agreement. Of course, the United States pushed hard for that, is right in the middle of that. Here's the president-elect in December talking about the Paris Agreement.
I don't want that agreement to put us at a competitive disadvantage with other countries. And as you know, there are different times and different time limits on that agreement. I don't want that to give China or other countries signing agreements an advantage over us.
Of course, China, as we just heard Daniel Kamen say, moving ahead with a lot of clean energy solutions. The U.S. this week going in a different direction. The president this week talking a lot about coal, and where the president might have said that he was open-minded in December, get a feeling here, this is from this month. This is at the White House, Office of Management and Budget Director Mick Mulvaney explaining President Trump's rationale for eliminating funding for science and climate change research.
Regarding the question as to climate change, I think the president was fairly straightforward. We're not spending money on that anymore. We consider that to be a waste of your money to go out and do that. So that is a specific tie to his campaign.
Daniel Kamen, I hope we have you back there now. We heard tape of the president saying in December, nobody really knows about climate change.
Well, I'm definitely back, and so apologies for that. And I heard the quote, and it's so unfortunate. And it's unfortunate because the scientific community has done extensive research. It's not just a few scientists in Europe or California. It's a global, very clear assessment of the very strong connection between human release of greenhouse gases, so-called anthropogenic emissions, and the climate change that we're seeing. And this is really not a subject of scientific debate anymore.
Have we, in this week, I mean, I'm just still trying to take on board what this means. Maybe China will lead the way and things will be all right, but maybe are we signing some kind of death sentence this week with the president sort of saying no thanks to all those measures that were intended to keep us on a better trajectory, Daniel?
Well, I think there's two parts to that. One is that China alone isn't going to solve the problem. And in fact, you can argue that having some healthy, friendly competition to race to green energy actually accelerates everyone's activities. And so what China's doing is important. What the U.S. has been doing, what Europe is doing, Japan, many places are doing really important things in this area. And so I do think that if this kind of defunding of the basic understanding of climate and clean energy goes through, then we are signing a death knell to the extent that the growth in clean energy companies that's produced incredible job growth in the U.S., documented job growth, sort of not deniable, and very significant economic gains. And people often talk about energy, clean energy, or economic growth. But what we're seeing in parts of the U.S. that have invested in it, Massachusetts, New York, California, elsewhere, parts of Europe, I just came back from Kenya where the same story is in place, is that very clearly this clean energy revolution produces jobs. And so it's ironic to hear all of this discussion about defunding as a way to save money. In fact, for me, it really reminds me of a famous quote when the Congress was debating something called the Office of Technology Assessment, where the quote was, "This is like going on a diet by cutting out 2 ounces of brain matter."
Daniel Kamen, University of California, Berkeley, thanks for being with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.